that would allow them to vet all information available before weighing whether to confirm Gabbard to Trump's cabinet. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, October 22nd, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the challenges ahead for the Latino LGBTQ community with a new Donald Trump Republican-led administration on the horizon. And so with us to discuss this important issue today is Karma Chavez, who's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities. She joins us on the show today. Welcome back to the show, Karma Chavez.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Absolutely. So let me begin by prefacing that mainstream media often makes the mistake of trying to make a distinction between quote-unquote establishment Republicans and quote-unquote MAGA Republicans. The truth is that there is a distinction without a difference. And one huge example was the huge wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation that we saw throughout the country last year. All of these bigoted bills that we saw in 2023 were led by Republicans with no distinction being made. So obviously what brings us to this conversation today is the dark shadow of a new Trump administration coming along. But before we even begin discussing the new Trump administration, let's start by discussing the wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation last year and how it sort of serves as perhaps a harbinger of what we saw this year. You know, before we even started recording the show today, I told you that last year there were so many copycat anti-LGBTQ laws going out throughout the country that it felt like it was hard to keep up with each and every one. and what it meant for each and every state, each and every community. So I felt like we need to begin here in order to understand that what's taking place this year did not begin this year. And it didn't even begin in 2023 either.
Yeah, no, it didn't begin 2023. It didn't begin with Donald Trump. I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is we've seen attacks on the LGBT community for a long time. It's hard to keep that in mind when we think about some of the issues that people consider to be wins, like the legalization of same-sex marriage, et cetera. But yeah, 2023 was a rough one. I think the ACLU says there were 510 anti-LGBTQ bills that were proposed in almost every single state across the country. I think all the states, but maybe three, proposed at least one anti-LGBTQ bill. And these bills ranged from things like, probably among the most common were school sports bans. And these are about banning transgender athletes from being able to play sports on the team of the gender that they identify with. A lot of these were also about locker rooms and who can use what locker rooms and what bathrooms in schools. Some of them were related to actual curriculum censorship. And so these we might think of as the banned books laws, which largely got rid of, I would say, trans content and any genderqueer content. We can't, of course, forget about the drag queen laws, the anti-drag queen laws that make it, you know, so the drag queens can't do readings at libraries or, you know, have any kind of connection at all. There were more healthcare restrictions, specifically making it harder for trans folks to be able to get access to healthcare in order to not be in a state of gender dysphoria. And there are a wide range of others. I mean, they were just kind of all over the place. You know, where I live in Texas, I think our legislators proposed 55 anti-LGBTQ laws. Not all of those got passed, but some of them did. So yeah, it was a rough year last year.
Yeah, certainly. And I do want to expand on the issue of free speech on college campuses as well, particularly in Texas, because Governor Greg Abbott over there was pretty much front and center with this anti-DEI hysteria that we saw last year, in addition to all this anti-LGBTQ legislation that we saw. And I think it'll be very clear that the people that are pushing the anti-DEI stuff are the same people that are pushing the anti-LGBTQ stuff throughout the country. It's almost one and the same. And it's interesting that you mentioned the ACLU. You mentioned that at least 500 such bills passed last year alone. I think it's 232, maybe the exact number this year. It's still a high number. But as you said, 2023 was a particularly rough year. And it expands not just to education and freedom of speech, but also public health as well. As we record this conversation today, reports have suggested that Trump may appoint the anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Among many problematic views on public health, RFK Jr. has been reported to be in favor of restricting access to gender-affirming care for transgender minors. He has also peddled conspiracy theories as it pertains to HIV and AIDS within the LGBTQ community. All disturbing. I'm curious to know, where do we begin to process the dangers of this line of thinking in the highest medical posts in the country? And I'm not just saying that as a host of a show. I'm telling you this as somebody who's also worked for many years in the public health sector. And I'm just as alarmed as to what's going to happen here, because even during the pandemic, I'm not sure if the medical institutions of this country at the highest level are prepared for somebody to just destroy things. The very nature of medical science, it's just alarming and disturbing to see what's going to happen on the horizon here.
This is a challenging one. I mean, I'm not a historian. My last book, The Border of AIDS, though, was a historical book and what was looking at questions around public health and activism, immigration, and HIV. And, you know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind about public health at the federal level is that the way that it's been enacted has often had a sort of antagonistic relationship with communities that are marginalized. So whether that's around sexuality or whether that's around race. So, of course, we can think about the Tuskegee experiment in Alabama in the early 20th century as perhaps the most egregious example of this. But we can also think about the things that happened during the 1980s with regard to HIV and AIDS. And in that case, because of rampant homophobia, you know, the public health service took some positions that made it very hard for people to get access to the care that they needed. They didn't get the funds appropriated that they needed. And in fact, the public health service endorsed a ban on HIV positive immigrants, despite that there was not a public health rationale for that. So I just offer those couple of examples to say that people from marginalized backgrounds in this country have always kind of had an antagonistic relationship with public health, even when there are actual experts in some of these roles. Now, when you get to the situation that we might be looking at now with someone who doesn't have a medical degree, someone who doesn't have a background outside of, as far as I can tell, you know, conspiracy theories and sort of fringe views that don't hold up to scientific merit, I think we're putting everybody at risk. But as we know, if everybody's at risk, that's not going to be doled out in the same way for everyone. And so folks that come from marginalized backgrounds are going to get it the worst. And we've seen already that trans folks are the absolute target when it comes to healthcare right now. There's a lot of hysteria around what it means for trans people to have the affirming healthcare they need, whether they're teenagers or adults. And I think that's probably, for me, one of the biggest particular concerns, although I think the concerns are extend far beyond that as well.
Yeah, in the coming weeks ahead, one of the things that we plan to do on the show is to dedicate an hour exclusively with regards to Haitians, the Haitian community here in this country, and how they were demonized during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, not only in the 80s, but in the early 90s as well. And so it's also quite timely considering how the Haitian community as well became a punching bag during this electoral cycle. And if you're Haitian and also part of the LGBTQ community, it's an even more disturbing time period, to say the least, in these times as well. So during the course of this presidential campaign, I feel so embarrassed in bringing this up. We saw perhaps the most vile and bigoted campaign commercials against the LGBTQ community on network television, cable TV news, and on social media. I'm curious to know what your thoughts on the normalization of such bigotry on mainstream media during the course of this 2024 electoral cycle alone, because I have to say that it's one thing for mainstream media to take advertising dollars to run these ads, because I've done countless shows here with regards to the ills of capitalism, especially as it pertains to journalism. But it bothers me how people who are otherwise decent and supportive on so many other things can normalize this thing and not at the very least raise alarm bells that this is not okay. It's one thing to see the opportunism of taking ad revenue for these ads, but what bothers me equally as much is the indifference of otherwise good people in normalizing what we saw during the course of this electoral cycle.
Well, has this not been the year of normalizing that which is absolutely egregious? And maybe I shouldn't even mention the fact of what's happening in Gaza right now. We have normalized so much. And when it comes to the LGBT community and the ways that it's once again become okay to target us, to make us seem in all sorts of ways that, you know, some may be true, right? I mean, we have to accept the fact that there are folks in the LGBT community, like there are folks in the straight community, who like all sorts of stuff, right? So, and I don't think that should be demonized. And those we may think are, we know those representations are meant to be demonizing in a certain way, but I think there also has to be space to say, hey, whatever you want to do in your bedroom, you want to do in your bedroom, however you want to dress. Having that said, I think what's most terrifying for me really has to do both with youth and those who are really struggling with their mental health. When that kind of discourse gets normalized, I mean, we've seen this throughout history. The truth is, it's just been the last few years where it hasn't been okay to be absolutely homophobic in public. So we're kind of back to maybe where we were 15, 20 years ago. And it's really scary for, like I said, those two groups in particular. But in general, I think to be a queer person in this environment, it's like, you know that people don't necessarily think you're human. And you know that some people might think you're human, but they're okay with the fact that other people don't think it. And they're okay with them having their quote unquote free speech to express those views. Meanwhile, we're trying to ban DEI on college campuses.
Yeah, I've been following your social media accounts in the last couple of days, and you've been very vocal with what's been going on in Gaza. And at first glance, one may think that the issue of Gaza and LGBTQ rights are not one and the same, but they are one and the same in terms of the people that are trying to clamp down on both those rights and the freedom of speech. And so that's sort of my interpretation of the parallels between those two issues. Are there other parallels that you would like to point out as well? I know that in the state of Texas, as you mentioned before, there's been this anti-DEI crusade by the governor. And you're right, it has led to people losing their jobs on college campuses and even public schools as well. Are there other parallels that people need to pay attention to? While these two stories seemingly run parallel one another, there are some things that people need to point out that bring these two stories closer together.
Yeah, I think there are. It's probably more complicated than we have time to get into on this show, given the time we have. But I'll say a couple of things. For one, the attacks on DEI, I think, are, if I'm understanding the landscape, and I think I do a lot of research in this area, the attacks on DEI are fundamentally about not liking a certain story about Black history in this country, and also not liking the existence of a kind of mainstream LGBTQ identity or content in schools, with a, I would say, an emphasis on the T, not to mention where those two issues come together. So I think those are some of the real underlying concerns when it comes to anti-DEI. How does anti-DEI come into existence? Well, there's lots of ways we could trace this. Of course, we can trace it to Christopher Rufo and the Manhattan Institute, but we can also trace it to the Heritage Foundation. And of course, those two entities are similar to one another. But the Heritage Foundation has put out a 2021 report that essentially was about how DEI workers supposedly are anti-Semitic. And so that in order to root out anti-Semitism on campuses, we needed to get rid of DEI on campus. Now, that's not the only justification for getting rid of DEI. Christopher Rufo has another set of justifications for why he thinks it should be, and those have been taken up by state legislatures. But the point is that the charge of anti-Semitism is part of what's being weaponized to get rid of programming that has tried to present a more accurate and holistic view of queer folks and Black folks. And queer Black folks. And so you can look at Florida to see how, in particular, queer Black folks are the targets, right?
Yes, I was just about to mention that because early in 2023, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, had that famous speech, or infamous, shall we say, when he blocked AP African American Studies in the States. And one of the things that he specifically attacked was Black queer studies in his diatribe, but please continue.
Yeah, so I'm trying to show that, you know, the linkages between these things. I mean, there's other linkages when we're thinking about Gaza. Of course, there are queer folks in Gaza. There are queer folks dying. We also have to understand that Israel has often used a strategy that some scholars call pink washing, which is to say making itself look as if it's very queer friendly as a way to sort of wash over the fact that it's engaged in a settler colonial project. That's been before the more recent genocide. So there are a lot of ways in which queer rights intersect with the issue around Palestine and intersect with the issues more broadly around race in this country and the attacks on racialized people, especially Black folks.
Exactly. And going back to the issue of distorting history that you sort of mentioned in passing, we saw what the distortion of history looks like in a place like Florida late last year, because one of the things that ended up happening was some portion of the curriculum when it comes to African American studies in the state of Florida actually rationalized the use of slavery during that time, which just shocked and appalled so many people late last year. And because that story has sort of gone under the radar since, I don't know if that's still the case in Florida. Who knows? But the fact that people made that conclusion after people like Ron DeSantis, because we're not just talking about individuals, we're talking about this entire party, this entire political party, distorting history in such a way that they would rationalize slavery. And I think that's one of the motives, and I think you kind of alluded to this as well, one of the motives to this anti-DEI crusade that we've seen in places like Texas. And just to be clear, it's not exclusive to the state of Texas as well. So this is interesting because oftentimes when the LGBTQ community has been vilified under a magnifying glass by Republicans, underneath the community itself has been the issues of public education, public health, even labor rights as it pertains to workplace discrimination. In Texas, obviously you're more familiar than I am about Governor Greg Abbott and his anti-DEI crusade and how people have lost their jobs along the way. But without trivializing the real concerns of the LGBTQ community, like what we've discussed thus far, have people missed the reality that this community is being used as a punching bag to mask other issues that affect the country as a whole? I just mentioned three of them right there, but is this the right theory to sort of approach this for people who are not of the community or who may, dare I say, have sort of indifference to the whole issue at hand?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no political scientist, right, to be able to kind of map this completely. But I think one of the things that we can see is, for me, as someone who studies social movements and tries to understand the kinds of rhetoric that powerful actors as well as, you know, resisting actors use in a given moment in order to advocate for their positions, one of the things we see is the strategy of scapegoating. And scapegoating is an amazing tactic to create what we might think of as a moral panic. And so we know that there are particular issues that we can put up on the television screen or on Twitter or whatever it is that will incite a particular kind of moral panic. So abortion rights is one of those issues, and LGBT rights is one of those issues. And so even though we have in this moment, you know, ostensibly more LGB rights than we've had ever in American history, it's still a hot button issue. It's still the kind of issue that can provoke a moral panic. And what moral panics do throughout history is they absolutely do what you have suggested. They draw attention from the other, again, like you don't want to minimize, but the bigger issues that affect all of us, and they keep us from being connected to a broader struggle because we're sort of fascinated with the moral panic of the day, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned moral panic because we haven't even mentioned religious fundamentalism during the course of this conversation. And I feel that may be central to some of the things that are underlying this motivation as well, in addition to sort of the authoritarian nature that these lawmakers have had, almost obsession with regards to hitting this otherwise very small and vulnerable community. But again, I feel like it's a means to hit those things, like I said before, public education, public health, et cetera, et cetera. In the last few years, it has been quite clear to me that people that have pushed and promoted anti-LGBTQ legislation throughout the country are the same people that have pushed to roll back women's reproductive rights. For me, they are one and the same. In addition, it could also be argued that the same group of people have been pushing to clamp down on freedom of speech on college campuses, especially on Gaza, on the issue of Gaza, as you just mentioned. Can we talk about the issue of religious fundamentalism and how it sort of underlines some of the issues that we've just mentioned thus far?
I've written a bit about this in the past and tried to look into the ways in which a particular kind of Christian nationalism, we might call it, underlies a lot of the culture wars, I guess we could say. And so I think that a lot of these issues come to relevance as a result of a particular belief in what is morally right and what is morally wrong. And the fundamentalism piece of that, I think, is especially important because you have more moderate Protestant denominations, for example, than the Christian faith, who have grown quite liberal on a whole host of issues, but fundamentalists have not. And that's where these issues like abortion, women's rights more broadly, LGBT issues, continue to be at the forefront of an agenda. And I think if we look back a little bit historically, one of the things that happened in the Reagan administration is that Reagan and, you know, his cohorts, they weren't necessarily Christians, and they really didn't necessarily have a lot of need for Christianity in a kind of moral sense. But they did learn that they needed to create an alliance with fundamentalist, socially conservative Christianity for a variety of reasons. So one of those most obviously was for votes. But the other thing that made for this alliance was the neoliberal policies that Reagan wanted to roll out in the 1980s. These policies required embedding values into the culture, values related to personal responsibility, to the value of free trade, right, to the kind of extreme capitalism we have now. And so, you know, thinkers in the Reagan administration realized that the best way to do that was to fortify this alliance with social conservatives, fundamentalist evangelical churches, and get some of these ideas to be essentially part of the way that the faith was taught on in Sunday schools, on the catechism classes or whatever on Wednesday nights. And so it was built in. You would even have like financial responsibility classes being taught at these fundamentalist churches to get people into the idea of having credit, of having credit cards, which wasn't necessarily as popular then as it is now. And that really helped to not only fortify Christian conservatives to always vote Republican, even if Republicans may not have always supported all their interests, but it was an alliance then that was both religious, but also more ideological and cultural, I guess I would say. And I think we still see that today, that that has never quite waned because it allows their influence.
So if I'm reading you correctly here, and I do agree with you when it comes to capitalism undermining democracy, especially when it comes to the free movement of capital in particular. And so if I'm reading you correctly here, to summarize, is that Republicans, shall we say here, have used the religious values of this particular community as a means to pass austerity measures by using the LGBTQ community as a punching bag, especially in the 80s, especially at the dawn of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. The New York Times, a few years ago, I think, put out a video on YouTube. They actually found some leaked audio of Reagan administration officials laughing at people dying of HIV and AIDS. This was around 83, 84. They found this audio, this leaked audio, and they showed sort of how the Reagan administration handled HIV and AIDS during that time period. You know, it's not just one audio, but history has shown that they mishandled that situation sort of in the same way as the Trump administration mishandled the COVID pandemic as well.
You have to keep in mind that Ronald Reagan didn't make a public speech on AIDS until May of 1987. And AIDS was, you know, AIDS existed a lot longer than this, but it first enters into the public sphere in July of 1981. So by the time Reagan actually gives a speech on AIDS, 40,000 Americans had died. And the only reason he gave that speech, it's important to note this historically, was because the Senate was in the process of passing a ban on HIV-positive immigrants. This was basically the Reagan administration's, you know, first big thing that they're going to sign into law. So that's a history not a lot of people know. But part of that, again, was because of the moral stigma and the moral panic that existed around people who had AIDS, because who was it that had AIDS in the public imaginary? Of course, it's gay folks, it's drug users, it's sex workers, and of course, Haitians were thrown into that mix as well.
Yeah, I was just about to take a break here, but now that you mention the banning of immigrants during that time, during the Reagan years, I'm curious to know, what are your thoughts on the Biden administration banning people from entering the country using the Trump-era laws to block people during the COVID pandemic? And is it fair to say that that's sort of a loose parallel there? Because, again, the only thing in common there is the demonization of immigrants because of a disease that both governments, whether it be Trump or Reagan, and even Biden, didn't know that much about at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Title 42 is what was revised in order to be able to ban HIV-positive immigrants, first passed in 1987, codified in 1990 and 1993, existed as law until 2009 or 10. That was Title 42. That's Title 42 is what Trump used, and Title 42 is what Biden used. And so these are Republicans and Democrats alike using these same laws to promote a kind of nativism, I guess, you know, that disease doesn't originate here. And the only way to, you know, protect from disease in this country, even if we're the country who might be creating it the most, is to keep poor Black and brown folks out.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's nothing short of frustrating how both political parties have used that against immigrants and asylum seekers in both cases. So now we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Karma Chavez, who's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Uma bala quase hétero, etérea massa complexo de não se entender. Um canalha quase hétero, ignorar amor por complexo, medo de nele se ver. É necessário quebrar os padrões. É necessário abrir discussões. Alento pra alma amar sem portões. Amores aceitos sem imposições. Singulares, plural. Se te dói em ouvir, em mim dói. No carnal. Mas se tem um jeito, esse meu jeito de amar, que lhe dá o direito.
That was Criollo, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the challenges that the LGBTQ community face with a new Trump administration, with Karma Chavez, who's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities. So, Karma, over the years, we've done a series of shows in addition to what we do here called Undocumented and LGBTQ. And the tagline has always been the caravan within the caravan. And part of the reason why I use that tagline is because undocumented LGBTQ folks face a battle on two fronts. One, what we just mentioned mostly during the course of the show, which is a right-wing Republican-led attempts to marginalize and demonize the LGBTQ community. But for undocumented LGBTQ folks, they also have to face the challenges of bigotry within their own community, and in this case, within their own respective Latino community, because we have to be honest and say that there are people within the Latino community who would otherwise be liberal and progressive-minded on so many things, but when it comes to LGBTQ rights, it becomes a different story. And that's not something that's exclusive to Latinos, but to all immigrant groups, that this is an inconvenient truth that needs to be approached and dealt with as well. So I actually have two questions for you with regards to your book that I just mentioned, Queer Migration Politics. How does your book particularly deal with this sort of issue? Because we can even look at our own family members, see like friends and family who are like-minded on a variety of things that are progressive-minded. But when it comes to this particular issue, they suddenly become, I guess, conservative, for lack of a better term. So how do you confront this issue, whether it be within the community or even within friends and family?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. You know, one is, yes, Latino communities, immigrant communities certainly have issues with homophobia and transphobia, as do all communities. And I think it's always important that we, you know, locate this as a broader problem. I mean, the other thing I'll say is that several years ago, there was a report put out by the Audre Lorde Project that was trying to kind of push back a little bit on the thesis that immigrant and refugee communities were more homophobic than sort of non-immigrant and refugee communities. And so one of the things they found in their study was that the place that refugee and immigrant communities learned their homophobia was actually the white churches that provided services to them. Because most refugees in particular, there are a set of organizations that are almost all religious that resettle and provide services. And so I think there's a way in which we can return to that conversation about Christian fundamentalism in a certain sense and say, this is where this originates. Nonetheless, you're right. Of course, all of our communities are struggle with these issues. I think if we look at some of the issues we've been talking about throughout this show, the question related to expectations around the gender binary and expectations around gender performance, I think we have to take really seriously here. That is fundamentally, to me, one of the big issues across communities that people struggle with. So if men aren't men and women aren't women, what's that mean, right? So if they're not engaged heterosexually, if they're not embodying gender in a way that conforms to the norm of whatever that idea is in a given culture, that is a source of anxiety, including giving women the rights to have control over their own bodies. Because in a patriarchal society, which is the society we live in, right, men have control over women. That's the way it works. And so I think in all of these issues, the fundamental question we have to ask ourselves is, why do we hold on to gender norms so tightly? And I don't know, that's maybe one way to begin those conversations. I know my own dad has come a long way on these issues through years and years of conversations.
Yeah, it's, like I said before, an inconvenient truth within the community, but one that needs to be faced and one that requires, or should I say necessitates, a deep look in the mirror, especially when it comes to anyone who's sincerely looking to push on the side of social justice and human rights as well. We've gone this far into this conversation and we have not mentioned Project 2025, which is this right-wing project that hits on a variety of things, including LGBTQ rights. I tried to avoid actually mentioning that in the conversation today because, considering what we discuss with all the anti-LGBTQ legislation that we saw in 2023, it almost feels like there are certain states that are already putting Project 2025 into practice. The state of Texas alone is one example of that. And even then, the name Project 2025 is a misnomer, in my opinion, because it's not exclusive to the year 2025, and it'll likely go beyond that no matter who's in power in the presidency. How would you measure the importance of this sort of thing, considering everything that we saw in 2023 with the over 500 anti-LGBTQ bills that we saw, according to the ACLU, with this hypothetical that in some ways, or in a lot of ways, has already been put into practice or tried to be put into practice at the state level in various parts of the country?
Yeah, I'll be very honest and say that I've not read Project 2025. I've read summaries about the way it would impact different communities I'm a part of and communities I care about. I do think there's a lot to be said for the agenda that the state of Texas has been trying to put into place for the last several years. And what I understand Project 2025 would like to put in at the national level. I mean, if you think about the main issues that I think are focused on, it's questions related to family, it's questions related to trans folks, and questions related to health, you know, all in ways that would impact all people who are members of that community, but specifically have the most negative impact on folks who are trans, folks who are poor and working class, who are houseless, those kinds of things, sort of already struggling. And so, you know, that's what we've seen in Texas. Trans folks, for example, who can flee, many have gone because it makes it too hard to live here if you can't get the health care you need or use the bathroom you need to use. So what are we going to do when this is nationwide? It's a real challenging question. And it's going to come with, I think, more protections for the stuff we were talking about earlier with all these anti-LGBT ads that were so prolific during the election cycle. You know, people's bigotry is going to be defended by a First Amendment argument. So there's going to be more of that as well. It's dire, I think, for folks who care about human and civil rights across the board.
Karma, last week on the show, I had freelance writer Arturo Dominguez on the show with us. He's a good friend of mine and of the show. And we had an intense conversation of why the Latino vote went the way it did with regards to Trump. And we mentioned the issue of LGBTQ rights. And Arturo said here on the show last week that he is the father of a trans child. And discussing, you know, the challenges that this community faces in the coming years ahead, I could hear the anger and the contempt in his voice with how this community has been demonized and marginalized just in the state of Texas alone. And it reminded me of how there have been some cases, or some stories rather, of people sending their children to live with relatives outside the state or in other parts of the country to get away from this anti-LGBTQ sentiment, or perhaps more importantly, to get the medical care that they need outside the state because the state of Texas is no longer offering it or has taken it away altogether. And this sort of boils my blood as someone who's worked in the healthcare industry over the years. But I'm curious to know, have you heard these stories before? I'm not saying anything beyond what Arturo told me on the show last week, but have you heard these stories of, dare I say, family separations out of necessity because of the healthcare needs and because of a need to just get away from the demonization that people see on television, in social media, wherever have you? Because again, there's a component here that I don't think we mention often enough, and that's the issue of mental health and how all this bigotry affects the community as well.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I have definitely heard of folks who are sending their kids to live with relatives that are in more progressive states so they can get the medical care. I have friends, not in Texas, but in Alabama, who have moved out of state, even though they have deep, deep generational roots in the state of Alabama as a result of anti-trans laws because their child needs health care. I know a number of adults who are, you know, trying to leave as well. So I think it is a family separation issue, and I think it's much broader than that. But I did want to just mention the thing you said before about, you know, the number of Latinos who voted for Trump. And I think, you know, I think we want to be careful about reinforcing that narrative too. I mean, it's not Latinos' fault that Trump got elected. Let's focus on the fact that white folks are continuing to vote for Trump. So, I mean, I think even though the numbers have gone down, I mean, I was talking to a friend who studies this today, and she was telling me that it's looking like the original 46% number is now under 40%. So, you know, I think there's still some questions to ask about that as well. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And I would say anecdotally that it's more to do with disillusionment rather than any rah-rah type of support for Trump or the Republican Party as a whole. I think disillusionment may have been the main word of this electoral cycle, you know, among other things. But I want to go back to what I said, which is my second question with regards to your book, Queer Migration Politics, is that, is there anything that we could draw from your book or anything that conjures up in your mind right now that could give people some degree of hope, some degree of inspiration, and some degree of understanding that, hey, we've been down this road before. We defeated it. We surpassed it. We overcame it. Is there something, without sounding too romantic about it, anything that people can draw from that could be both inspiring and enlightening during this uncertain future that we're seeing in front of us?
Yeah, I'll say two things on that. The first one is, you know, my book is really looking at a snapshot in time from about 2006 to 2012, when queer undocumented youth took the country by storm in many ways. They really challenged the way that we thought about immigration as an issue. They also challenged the way that we thought about what it meant to be LGBT as an issue, and they built bridges between these communities. And, you know, the sad part of that story is that a lot of folks advocated for the DREAM Act, and the DREAM Act never got passed. People came out as undocumented and unafraid, and still the DREAM Act never was passed in its place. We got the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which is once again going to be under threat with Trump. But the thing that I think is actually really hopeful about that story is the amount of political growth and community building that these young folks made. And a lot of those young folks, when I was writing about them, you know, they're actually pushing 40 now. And so maybe not so young anymore, but they generated, they energized a powerful and long-lasting movement. And we have to keep in mind that with all of these issues that we're facing as a community under Joe Biden, and we're going to face as a community under Donald Trump, they are different, of course, but we face issues under both. The arc of justice, as they say, is long. And so movement building takes time. It may not be in our lifetimes, right, that we see what we want to see, but it's about the struggle as much as it's about the destination. And I think that's really what those young people demonstrate. And I'm always energized by that. And the other thing that I want to mention, which is not connected to my book, but connected to someone I consider a North Star, who is Maryam Kaba, who's a prison abolitionist and an activist. And she's this Black feminist who's done incredible work in all these ways all across this country for years. And everybody's in this state of despair. You know, there's white women's tears all over the computer screen. And what does Maryam Kaba do? She creates a series of pay-by-donation lessons for new organizers. So for those who just want to get involved now, we know that that can be a disaster, but Maryam's taken this opportunity to just create a whole new curriculum so that people can learn from, in my view, the absolute best in terms of organizing. If that's not an example of what she says, hope being a discipline, I don't know what is.
That's a fantastic story. And it shows you that this book, Queer Migration Politics, shows that you don't have to be part of the community itself, the LGBTQ community, to understand that sort of information, inspiration, and enlightenment. Now, I want to ask you the same question, but apply it to your other book, The Borders of AIDS. I'm optimistic enough to feel that medical science will prevail in these next 4 years, in spite of all these scary people that are getting into, you know, health and human services, not just RFK Jr., but some other characters as well. I feel confident enough that medical science will prevail here. At the same time, I was wrong with regards to, you know, how Roe versus Wade was sort of destroyed, despite people with no medical experience in the room making those decisions, which still drives me mad. But nonetheless, in spite of all that, the same question applies. What sort of inspiration or understanding or enlightenment can people draw from that particular book, The Border of AIDS?
That book is also a book about the power of organizing in many ways, and about the power of really being able to provide a deep diagnosis of what's wrong, and then being creative and building community to try to make things better. There's maybe less hope in the sense that I was describing before related to the other book. But on the other hand, I think that what AIDS showed us in some very concrete ways was that when ordinary people put their mind to something and they put their resources to something and they don't police each other and they engage in a coalitional fashion, they can actually change the course of history. And that's what AIDS activists did in putting so much pressure on the FDA to ensure that their perspectives were heard and to demand that scientists who ordinarily do everything that they can to remain quote unquote objective, that they became politicized because it was a matter of life and death for them to do it. And I think that kind of grit is probably what's going to be needed at this historical moment for folks to make sure that people don't die, to make sure that people are getting the healthcare they need.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what, that hits very close to home, because as far as I'm concerned, I'll be very blunt here, that the healthcare system is such here in this country where if you do not have money, if you do not have health insurance, you will die. That's sort of the blunt nature of the healthcare system in this country. And it doesn't have to be that way. We saw during the pandemic, especially in 2020, that the government is able to give financial support to people as it pertains to whether it be rent, businesses, or healthcare for that matter. And that was quickly shut down almost a year later because the powers that be did not want to awaken the body politic of this country to a possibility that we've been told for generations was impossible, which is helping people at the government level in a manner in which they did in the early months of 2020. And so this is precisely why I love to have guests like Karma Chavez on the show, not just to enlighten us on these amazing stories and the issues at hand, but also to have this radio program as a form of education, because education is certainly under attack right now. And I want to end this conversation by being curious to find out, considering all the anti-DEI stuff that's happening in a place like Texas alone. And again, this issue is not exclusive to Texas, but I'm curious to know how faculty, how academia is fighting back with what's being pushed in regards to anti-history, anti-education, or just assaults on public education, especially when it comes to funding and resources. I'm curious to know how academia is fighting back, because what's being applied in Texas, I feel, could be applied nationally if this upcoming Trump administration has their way.
Well, all signs point in that direction. One of the things that I'll say, and it probably won't surprise you, is that academics are not very good organizers. Academics don't imagine themselves generally as workers, particularly the ones that have the most job security. So there's an irony there. And so it's been very hard to organize faculty in Texas and around the country for the last several years as these attacks have become even more intense. But we're doing our best. There are organizations like the American Association of University Professors, which has been one of our primary organizing units here. We're also affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. We've worked closely with organizations like PEN America and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as well as others, to try to get ourselves organized as faculty, as people who care about what it means to learn our history, to learn our cultures, to teach controversial ideas, and to defend ourselves as private citizens, because we have the right to do that. And so we've been trying to use it. It's hard to say what that's going to look like. I'm not sure we're going to win the battle here in Texas. I really believe ethnic and gender studies in the state of Texas is under threat, as in these departments and programs could get eliminated. And that will pave the way for something similar nationally. And so everybody, even in so-called blue states, should be really prepared to defend education, because that's going to be absolutely necessary.
Absolutely, you're right. And I'll say this to wrap up, is that outlets like WPFW, at the very least, can do its part by giving the platform to fantastic guests like Karma Chavez. So we've been speaking with Karma Chavez, who's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, Karma Chavez.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Tens of thousands of people are fleeing the city of Homs, Syria's third largest, as Syrian opposition forces advance toward the capital city of Damascus. The rebels seized the city of Hama yesterday and last week took control of Aleppo, the country's second largest city. The rebel coalition consists of well-established and armed Islamist factions. The main opposition group's leader told CNN yesterday the coalition's goal is to ultimately overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. A senior Iranian official told Reuters today that Iran aims to send missiles and drones to Syria and increase the number of its military advisors there to support Assad. For Iran, Assad is a crucial ally in its resistance to Israel and U.S. influence in the Middle East. The escalation in fighting in Syria has displaced about 280,000 people in just over a week, the UN said today, warning that the numbers could grow to 1.5 million. In more international news, in a surprise about-face, the leader of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's own party is backing impeachment of the president. Opposition parties are pushing for a parliamentary vote tomorrow on Yoon's impeachment, calling his short-lived martial law declaration an unconstitutional, illegal rebellion or coup. But they need at least 8 votes from members of the president's People Power Party to get to the 2/3 majority required to pass the impeachment motion. During an emergency party meeting, leader Han Dong-hun stressed the need to suspend Yoon's presidential duties swiftly. His comments increased the likelihood that the impeachment bill against Yoon would gain enough support to pass through the National Assembly. If impeached, Yoon would be suspended from office until the Constitutional Court decides whether to reinstate or remove him. In domestic news, President-elect Donald Trump yesterday named 2 men with deep immigration enforcement experience to run the 2 key enforcement agencies that handle the border and deportations. Trump said he was nominating Rodney Scott as Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection. Scott served for almost 3 decades in the Border Patrol and served as the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol under Trump's first term. During that time, he implemented Trump's Remain in Mexico policy. Trump also chose Caleb Vitello to serve as the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. Vitello is currently the assistant director of the Office of Firearms and Tactical Programs. Both men, if confirmed, are likely to play a crucial role in helping Trump deliver his hard-line immigration policies that include a pledge to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. And nearly 100 former national security officers signed a letter criticizing President-elect Donald Trump's decision to nominate former Representative Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence, citing her alleged sympathy for dictators like Vladimir Putin and Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. The former officials added that if confirmed, Gabbard would be the least experienced person to hold the position since the role was created. It was addressed to the current Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, and incoming Majority Leader, Republican John Thune. The ex-officials went on to urge the Senate to hold closed sessions that would allow